Hey, health junkies. It's time for The Health Fix. Join your host, Dr. Janine Krause, as she gives you a dose of what you need to know and do right now to take control of your health from the inside out, to rebel against aging, look damn good, fight stress, and laugh every day.
Hello there, health junkies. Welcome to another episode of The Health Fix. Today, I'm interviewing Dr. Tom Inkledon. We will be talking all about the questions you need to be asking about cancer and how Dr. Tom gets amazing results by helping his patients reconnect their brains to their muscles to create strong muscles that take nutrition away from cancer cells. So it's a different approach in terms of cancer care, and he's got some really great ideas. Dr. Tom holds a bachelor's degree in exercise science and nutrition, a master's in kinesiology, and a doctorate in exercise physiology. He's a regular contributor to health and fitness magazines such as Men's Health, and he's the founder and CEO of Cosenta Wellness, a wellness and cancer treatment center in Scottsdale, Arizona. Dr. Tom's clinic helps patients improve their quality of life and provides transformational results for those seeking to improve their athletic performance. In fact, on his website, he has quite a wall of fame in terms of athletes that he has worked with. He's a former competitive Olympic level weightlifter who became severely ill after a lifting event, causing him to lose 30 pounds in just 3 days. The trauma he endured in those days is the inspiration behind his work today. After coming back from his illness, he went on to be a powerlifter and a strongman competitor. In 2000, when a truck tire injured his knee severely during a strongman competition, he used his foundation in strength building and nutrition once again to battle back and crush the competition the following year. Dr. Tom's resume is impressive, as is his goal to eradicate disease from the face of the earth. Of course, as luck would have it, I didn't press record right away for our interview. So we're going to jump right to the questions you should be asking about cancer. On with the podcast.
Your head, that can interfere with your ability to make an accurate decision. The first question would be, how will you treat the cancer in my body? And the reason why it's so important is you're going to get a quick understanding of the philosophy and the capabilities of that center, that doctor's office, whatever the context may be. And so if you go somewhere and they already have a solution before they know your name, you already know you're a number. You are not an individual human being. And I'll just insert some Trivial Pursuit-like details, and that is everyone alive today is so unique that not only are you the only person alive today that like yourself, you're the only person in history. So you're not one out of about 7 or 8 billion. You're one out of about 50 or 60 billion. And the reason is the interactions between the human genome and the microbiome are so incredible that we can't predict all the different possible scenarios. And so you can't just walk into a center and they do standard of care medicine and magically expect things to work. We already know from an optimal biology perspective that's a flawed approach. Yet unfortunately, that's how it is done worldwide because it generates an incredible amount of revenue. And so what we have seen is that the business interests of medicine are now outweighing the optimal biological results of treating human beings. And so the reason for that first question is it gives the person with cancer or it gives their family, whoever their loved ones are working with them, a quick sense of, is this the right place? You know, like if you walk in the door and they got Hair's treatment program ABC and you're like, well, how do you know that'll help the cancer, fight the cancer in my body? Then that you kind of right away get to see what's going on. And then the second question, this is really important because I very rarely have people ask this question, and that's what will you do when it doesn't work? And the reason why that's so critical is I watch all these people go somewhere and their line of questioning is like this, hey, do you take insurance? And the center goes, yes, we take insurance. And then they go, okay, I'm going to go there. And then they find out after a year and after they're weaker than ever, they now find out, well, there is no plan B. So the original treatment didn't work. Now they're weaker than ever. They're too weak to stand. They can't go to the bathroom on their own anymore, and there is no other option given to them. And the reality is there's plenty of options to help people, but they may not be profitable. And because they're not profitable, most patients don't get, they're not given the opportunity to even explore those options. So I realize that was a bit longer than probably wanted, but the two questions are, you know, how we fight the cancer in my body, or how we help me beat the cancer in my body. And then the second one is, what will you do when that doesn't work? And just to make things easier, on our website, we have a free ebook that people can download and has all the stuff right now for them to make it easier for them.
Oh, perfect. That's wonderful. I know that will be extremely helpful for anyone who's just first trying to figure out those two questions exactly. Like, what do I do? And, you know, what do I do if it doesn't work? But I think this is what brings up a really great topic that you have on your website and note, is the concept of personalized oncology, tailoring treatments to the person, their genetics, their current nutrition status, their current weight status, their current strength status. So tell us a little bit more about all of the different ways that you guys work to tailor oncology treatments to certain patients.
Yeah, so first, from an education perspective, when someone walks through the door, we want them to be at least become aware of what's available to help them. And then we want people to have the right to make up their mind on what they choose to do. There's no there's no way we can look at a human being and there's like an answer, like how to treat this person. It's not that answer is not stamped on their forehead or their body. So we have to accept the fact that they may look like a home run on paper, meaning like they have a cancer we should be able to treat easily, but cancer cells mutate. And because of changes in the genomics and the phenotypic expression within the cancer cells, they may go down pathways that no one's ever seen before, has experience dealing with. So typically, we look at all their medical records to see what was done. And in many cases, we find that patients were treated with a single drug or a combination of drugs, but there was nothing done at the same time to enhance the effectiveness of those drugs. So think of it as, imagine within a cancer cell, you have the brains of the cancer cells referred to as the nucleus, and the rest of the cancer cell, we'll just say it's the cytoplasm or the non-nuclear material in the cell. And within that cell, many of the drugs may be targeting the nucleus. So you have this much larger portion of the cancer cell that's totally being ignored. And so imagine now, the area that the drugs are targeting, that area also has DNA repair mechanisms, meaning as quickly as a drug damages the nucleus is as quickly as it's fixing it. So you get to the point where the drugs just teach the cancer cell how to fix damage faster. They don't actually win the war against the cancer cell. So what we do is we target, and in that particular case, we're going to target the rest of the cancer cell where it does not have those same repair mechanisms. And now it would be kind of like, you know, like popping a balloon in three or four spots as opposed to one spot. And the result of that now is we could actually take drugs that didn't work in the past for that patient and actually make them far more effective. And think of that approach there. Think of that as just purely killing cancer. Like, that doesn't affect your nutritional status, doesn't make you smarter, doesn't make you stronger or more coordinated, etc. Doesn't build up immune function. So now raise the question, what about all those other things I just mentioned? Well, that's where we have other professionals here. We have a naturopathic doctor, we have a physical therapist, we have a strength coach, and these other professionals then look at the other aspects of that individual's health. And then all the docs talk together, almost like coaches, you know, on a football team or something, where they strategize how we're going to, you know, beat the team they're playing next weekend. our professionals are strategizing, like, how we're going to help address everything. Because there are practical matters that people don't always think about. Like, normally what happens is when people get a diagnosis of cancer, and at least when they come here, they've been exposed to healthcare in a way where it's kind of like, you know, you're inconvenience, and we're going to try something, but it may not work, and guess what? There's no cure for cancer. So there's kind of like a negative connotation, everything going on. And now when they come here, none of the doctors wear lab coats. Everyone's smiling and laughing. We will move stuff around the building to accommodate a patient. It creates a little bit of chaos, but you start to get the sense now that people actually care for you. If they're going to move stuff from one side of the building to the other side to make sure you get all the treatment or therapy that you're supposed to get, you feel special now. Where have you been where someone's moved heavy equipment from one end to the other? That usually doesn't happen in most places. And I'm driven by, I'm highly competitive. I've been the best in the world in 5 different sports. I have no interest in competing for second place. And I'm the force pushing things forward with all the professionals here because I want to see results. I want people to get bigger, faster, stronger. And by the way, there's no evidence of disease anymore. And so as all these things come together, it produces some pretty cool results.
Absolutely. You have some very impressive testimonials on your website. I think the one that I found impressive was the gal who came in a wheelchair and left without the wheelchair. Do you want to share that story with our guests here?
Yeah, I'd love to. One, it's, I'm proud of a lot of the accomplishments that, that Team Cosenta has accomplished. The relationships I've developed with people here, they're very meaningful and fairly deep. And so in that particular case, this was a young lady whose family had went to centers around the world, and they spent, well over $1 million, different treatments and different centers doing the different programs. And when the family had made a decision to come here, the young lady had a tumor in her neck that was pretty large, and it was blocking her airway and it was blocking her ability to swallow. So on the way physically here, it was about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, the family contacted me and notified me that their daughter, the mom, contacted me and said, my daughter stopped breathing. And of course she's stressed out, you can imagine your daughter stops breathing in front of you. It's a very traumatic, overwhelming experience because you don't want to see your child die before your eyes. So, we got her to an ER, and then I got my oncologist on the phone, and we talked with their oncologist at the hospital, and we were able to advise them on what to do and, how to do it and so forth. And basically, we were able to get a 30% reduction in the tumor. So we got her from couldn't breathe to breathing and swallowing to now basically she could swallow and breathe without any medical assistance, like no breathing devices, things like that. So the family had said, you guys accomplished more results in 3 days than all these other centers combined in 1 year. So now at this point, I still had not physically seen her. We were just, texting, emailing, talking on the phone. And now as the family's now, she gets discharged from the hospital. She's on the way here. So it was a Saturday. And I didn't know at that point that no one told me she was in a wheelchair. The last conversation I had, she was walking. Hmm. And then after that, it never came up about, she couldn't walk anymore. And so now, imagine Saturday morning, I'm opening up the center, just me and the family, none of the staff was here, because I didn't know, I wanted time to see what was going on with her so I could figure out what to do. And she's in a wheelchair, and I'm like, hey, how's it going? How long have you been in a wheelchair? And she'd been in a wheelchair for 2 to 4 months. And so I'm like, all right, well, today you'll be walking in an hour and you won't need this anymore. And so they look at me like I'm a quack, like, oh my God, this guy's crazy. And so I get her in the gym and I start doing some therapies. A little while later, she's walking and the family's just like, how did you know how to do all this stuff? And I'm like, I've been doing this for 30 years. This wasn't like I just woke up yesterday and made some stuff up. We got a lot of data from different body types. And then as my relationship with the family started to move forward, now they're more trusting of the crazy ideas I have in my head. Now, she couldn't lift a 1 pound or 2 pound dumbbell. And I was like, we got to get some muscle on you. So I made a bet with the family We had her in the gym one day, and she couldn't bench a 16-pound barbell. And so I said, all right, I want you guys to start working out. And the family was a little resistant, but I believe in power of community, meaning I want everyone to be doing something. So what I did is I made a bet that I would get her to lift a weight that she just could not lift one time. I'll have her do it 30 times before she leaves. And if she does it 30 times, then you all start working out with her every workout. And to like, okay, sure. They thought, there's no way it's going to be possible. But they don't understand neuromuscular facilitation and the brain and the nervous system, those kinds of things. Most people don't. And so now here we are like an hour later, and the daughter's benching this weight 30 times easily that she couldn't do one time before. They're like, oh my God, how did you know this stuff? And same thing, you know, we got lots of people we've worked with so we could study some of these things. So now I had the mother and the boyfriend working out. I still cannot get the dad to work out. But then the mom got in such good shape, people started asking me if she was our fitness director. And so it was a good experience overall for the family. And then the young lady wound up gaining about 40 pounds. And just to put things in perspective, most people, if you said, you know, they gained 40 pounds, in your mind, you kind of imagine they're like obese or fat or something. This young lady, after she gained 40 pounds, she was still very thin. So that's how, you know, that's how depleted her body was when she got here. But it was a really cool experience watching her get stronger and do all kinds of movements, not just one time, but now she could do them, you know, 20, 30 times easily. And at the same time, see, like her boyfriend was pretty strong and fit already. So it was more about her and her mom seeing their bodies change and, you know, and get the whole family's now much more fitness oriented.
Wow. I think a lot of people right now are going, that sounds amazing, but what are these neuromuscular education tools that you're using? What did you do exactly to get her from one rep to 30 in one day? If you could share a little bit of insight, because I'm a data person. My folks know me as wanting to know details and data. So what did you do exactly?
Yeah, so we would take standard neurological assessments that most physicians are trained on. The difference would be, like in most medical programs, as a doctor uncovers some of this information, their tools would be drugs or surgery, you know, in the allopathic medical world, where here our tool's going to be exercise and movement. Maybe we may introduce some light therapy or some magnetic fields. So an example would be, we start off first with Romberg stance. So that's both feet are touching. We have them barefoot or maybe in socks, but essentially we don't want them wearing any shoes or sneakers. They look straight ahead with their palms facing forward. We make sure there's no pain so they can mechanically get in that position. And then once they're standing in that position, you ask them to close their eyes. And then whoever, like on our side, whoever the therapist is or working with them, they're seeing the body sway. They go, you know, side to side or front back. And then we ask the person doing the test, can they, you know, just pay attention to what they feel? And then afterwards, we say, what did you feel? And we compare what they feel versus what our observation was. So imagine, like, if you were assessing me, and imagine if I'm going back and forth like a windshield wiper, and you go, Tom, how do you feel? And I go, I feel really stable. You know, there's sensory mismatch, right? That somewhere inside of me, I'm just not aware of things going on with my body. And I'm not sure if I made it clear, but their eyes will be closed, right, while you're observing them. Then let's just say they look fairly stable. Well, now we're going to make it a more challenging position. So we put one foot in front of the other. So your front foot heel touches your back foot big toe. That's called a staggered Romberg position or staggered Romberg stance. And now you're seeing, can they maintain that position? So first eyes are open. Then if they're stable, no pain, then you close the eyes and you see, do they fall to one side or the other? We tell people, the joke is, this is not a commitment test. If you lose your balance, open your eyes and catch yourself. There's no need to fall to the ground. No one's getting any points. And so we kind of make it, you know, a little bit fun and engaging. And eventually what we do basically is we're progressively making the test more challenging for the nervous system. And what we're doing as part of this increasing challenge is we're looking at how the cerebellum controls accuracy, balance, and coordination, and how their cerebellum on the side being challenged communicates to the opposite side cortex. And then based on what we see, so let's say they could stand on their left leg fine without, you know, without falling over, but when they get to their right leg, they just can't stand up on one leg. So now we're looking at the right side cerebellum and the left side cortex, and then we create an exercise program, which may be like one or two movements, so it's not like a crazy long program. And within seconds to minutes, we're creating a challenge to the nervous system. So basically, we get the communication between the different hemispheres or regions of the brain. And usually within, you know, maybe a minute to 10 minutes, they could do a, they could balance themselves better than they could before. And the rationale for introducing this is when I evaluated all the exercise programming by coaches and trainers globally and at different exercise organizations, what I saw was a complete ignorance of neurology, cartilage biology, articular neurology, some of the more advanced genomic and phenotypic expression. Like as a side tangent, this doesn't really pertain to what you asked, but I just want to give you some details that may help. Years ago, people would say, well, don't work out, you get muscle bound, and then the muscle turns to fat. Then later on, we learn, well, really, they're separate tissues, and you really can't convert one tissue into another. And then later on, we learn, well, there's actually stem cells all around the body, and under the right conditions, those stem cells can migrate to other tissues and actually become another tissue, or there are other chemical factors that may help those stem cells produce other signals called chemokines to turn on stem cells in other tissues. And now we know you actually can convert one tissue type to another tissue type. So we've kind of gone from this mental journey or educational evolution where it's like, can't be done, it can be done, it can't be done, can't be done, you know. But it comes down to the context of what was being studied. So none of the, you know, major exercise organizations make any allowances for all this new robust data that's coming out because it's simply coming out too quickly. And in the model that we created here, we can integrate technologies from around the world and do something like pretty quickly, like in a day to a week. And then we have really bright minds coming in that actually provide the missing puzzle pieces that we need so that we can, you know, fast track things. So as an example, I went to lecture in Costa Rica about some of the outcomes we have. And now we're comparing outcomes with patients that we have here with doctors from around the world. And there was no comparison. And the reason is no other center in the world actually has an exercise program anywhere close to what we do with our patients. And this is the one area that I think, in terms of raising the standard around the world, exercise does amazing things. One is it prevents loss of muscle from lack of use. And what you see over and over again when someone is diagnosed with any medical problem, they stop moving. And now as they get weaker, the doctors around will say things like, well, the cancer is eating away your muscle, you know, and that's why you're getting weaker. Instead of saying, well, what should we do to prevent the cancer from eating away your muscle? Well, you lift weights, you do things that challenge the muscle, and it turns on genes, it upregulates the expression of certain substances to now direct the nutrients from cancer to your muscle cells. And now guess what? You actually have a chance of beating cancer. But even if you didn't, the difference is that now you're living life under your own terms. You're going food shopping, you're making love to your husband or wife, you're going to the bathroom on your own, like all the things that, you know, many people take for granted when they don't have an impairment. And then you go to sleep and you don't wake up. So because the quality of life value is so high, there's not like a long suffering. Compare that to someone that's either not exercising or exercising incorrectly, you know, as they get weaker, then they'll be eventually on hospice and they'll be stuck in a bed and now they have to watch life go on around them. And if they have a lot of pain, they'll be on a morphine drips and they won't recognize the family members around them. And it's a very lonely death. It's not the type of death you would wish on anyone.
No, absolutely not. I mean, having watched my mom slide downhill over 10 years. And then in the end, I mean, the end was not pretty. Like you said, just going to sleep one day and not waking up. I think, of course, all of us want that for ourselves. And it seems like it could be very possible in terms of being able to live with cancer and live a successful longer life. Is that what you're seeing with some of your folks? Or are you seeing folks go completely into remission?
So I would say both. And okay. So the goal I have personally is when I work with anyone, anyone with cancer, is we want to kill every cancer cell we could find. And the simple reason is cancer has no mercy. Cancer doesn't take a holiday. It doesn't care if you're a nice person or if you're evil. It just attacks everything. It doesn't, it's kind of like, it's the ultimate form of, you know, there's no distinction or discrepancy or segregation. It just kills everything it could find. And so we want to basically fight it at that level, you know. But now we'd say practically, what will it take? And the reality is that there are lots of cancers that are so slow that you're going to die of another, you know, old age, another disease before the cancer takes you out. And then it's like, well, as long as it doesn't interfere with your ability to live life on your own terms, now it's like, well, how do I manage this that in a way you're comfortable with? And this is where there's lots of options to help people. Exercise, though, is one of the biggest weapons. And the reason is exercise addresses two things far better than any drug so far. And that is exercise helps address immunosenescence and immunoevasion. Immunosenescence is kind of like we all have immune systems. And why did our immune system allow cancer to grow? In general, we have natural killer cells. We have macrophages. We have different types of specialized cells that should go out and kill the cancer cells. And for some reason, anytime someone has, whether it's a blood cancer or a solid tumor cancer, it's like, hey, why aren't things working in my body the way they should be? Second thing about the immunoevasion is cancer cells can attach to things like platelets. Cancer cells have, remember, they started from healthy cells, so they have a lot of the genetic material is the same as our healthy cells. So cancer cells have the ability to avoid our immune cells. And exercise does a really fantastic job of helping get rid of the noise and allowing our immune system to do a better job at finding, targeting, not just cancer cells, but bacteria and viruses and all kinds of other stuff that we may not want. So by incorporating exercise alone in the right way, most people can make a dramatic impact on the quality of life, even if they do nothing to fight the cancer. But when I say the right way,
I was hoping you were going to say that. I was like, yeah, what is the right way? Please tell us.
Well, so, like, you know, like, so the stereotypes would be, like, usually women are more flexible and guys are tighter, right? So now if you just look across the population at large, you see more women doing yoga and stretching, right? And you see more guys lifting weights. So the right way to exercise is to individually assess what is weakest in that person's fitness and address it. Most people know things like, you know, they know body composition from body fat testing, know things like strength or maybe endurance. They may even know muscular endurance or maybe range of motion. But very few people know things like balance and agility, reaction time. Those are things that they're very critical fitness components that most people just never consider because an average gym is not really a way to test those things. So there's no way for someone to even know if they're making progress or not. But as we get older, the data is pretty clear that people that move the fastest tend to have the longest lasting and healthier lives because in order to move fast, a lot of systems have to be working well. You can't jump around if you know, if my knees and hips are jacked up beyond belief, I'm probably not winning any sprints, right? Because the cartilage surfaces, if they're there, can't articulate properly. You know, or if my nervous system is shot, I can't control my muscles in a coordinated way to move my body efficiently. So speed of movement turns out to be a pretty good predictor. But there's some other things a lot of times people don't think about. And one is healthy bodies move more. So they call that spontaneous physical activity is higher. So, anyone has ever had children, your child doesn't ask to warm up before they go and run. You know, when they got energy to run around playing and giggling and laughing. They don't stretch or do, you know, 5 minutes or 10 minutes of cardio before they lift weights. They just go out and just have fun. Yeah. And part of that is because they can. But as we get older, we have the baggage, the damage from our youth that we bring forward. You know, the injuries that we didn't really fix, right? And so now as we get older, things ache, things hurt. And now we have to do all the stuff to be ready to work out or exercise. And it should be reframed so that we think of it as, why am I losing my function over time? And what can I do to regain my youthful-like function? Because the healthiest people can get up and sprint without any injuries. Or they could get up and lift fairly heavy without worrying about their joints. And most people don't approach it that way. And the reason why that's important is because the difference between an 80-year-old man deadlifting 500 pounds and an 80-year-old man that can't sit up out of the chair is the brain. But everybody looks at their muscle on the outside because they forget, because it's so right in front of them. You see these big muscles. You think, whoa, what's going on there? You forget what drives the muscle. It's the nervous system. And what's driving the nervous system is the brain. And so the answers are in front of us, but sometimes, you know, because of visual bias, we get misdirected. Like, you know, if a guy has big biceps or a woman has, you know, very toned, lean physique, like now, especially in your CrossFit background, you see all these women with abs, probably, you know, more in CrossFit, you see as globally, you see more than ever in history. So you're drawn to looking at, you know, different areas of their physique, and then you forget what's driving that, you know, was behind it on the inside, and that's the brain and the rest of the nervous system.
And I think that's a huge component to mention, and I was hoping you were going to say something about that, because my trainer and I geek out all the time on what muscle's not firing, why is it not firing, think about it, you know, let's work on neuromuscular education with this so that you can lift more. And I think that this is huge, especially in the taking it, the aspect that you have with the cancer, but also kind of putting it out there to folks who want to prevent cancer. They need to be thinking about, okay, you know, don't go into the gym and keep doing your bro sets. Like, your body knows how to do that. Put it outside of its limits, like you're saying, with agility, balance. I love playing on the BOSU ball, and I know people look at me and go, oh, she's such an idiot. What is she doing on that BOSU ball? She's not going to get any stronger. I'm like, yes, I am, because I'm going to balance better. But yeah. Do you guys have BOSU balls? Do you have all the balance stuff? Do you have all that stuff in your office?
We do. And so the way you do that, though, to think about, so one, you know, when your experience is at you're at a higher level, right? Like many of the patients that come here, they can't get out of a wheelchair. I'm sorry, they can't stand yet, right?
Yeah.
They may be, you know, maybe 5 pounds or 10 pounds, maybe heavy. And so the balance work for them might just be standing, right? And mm-hmm. So a BOSU ball would be more challenging
yes.
than they could handle. And then the progression, this is where understanding where the weak links in the nervous system are and then modifying the regimen, it'd be something like this. So, you know, normally you would train both sides of the body equally. So whatever you do on the left, you do on the right or vice versa. But once you're assessing someone's nervous system and you see areas that aren't working, you now have to create a program that addresses what their neurological inefficiency or neurological weakness is. So it may mean doing something on one side, or it may mean maybe we have to electrically stimulate something to get it to work, right? Mm-hmm. And so an example would be carrying like a heavy object in your right hand while you're trying to walk a straight line.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're trying to affect the ability of the left hip and the muscles around it to engage and be recruited correctly. So creating, you know, we're creating a loading, an unbalanced loading across the body so that the brain has to basically pay attention more to what's going on. and do similar things with like loads. So then as people respond and now they're able to maintain their balance and stuff, then it could be things like stacking.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be something like, so imagine you go down into like a quarter squat or half squat, and you're holding that position, and across the body, let's say with your right hand, you grab a rope handle that's attached to 30 pounds on a cable, and you go across your body diagonally. So it's like, you know, a load is starting above your head on your left side, coming across your body on your right side. You're holding that deer while you're in the bottom of a, like middle to bottom portion of a squat position, like a back squat position.
Mm-hmm.
And then your left hand is extended towards the ceiling, and you're trying to do very precise circles with your shoulder.
Wow.
Yeah.
That sounds like patting on your head and rubbing your belly at the same time.
Oh yeah. And it gets even more advanced. Then over time, what I would do is I would have you reading stuff from an eye chart that's at different depths. And then as you grow and develop your brain, then I'm asking you, okay, Janine, say starting from December, say every other month backwards. So you're calling out letters from an eye chart at two different depths, like maybe 3 feet and 12 feet. You're answering questions, and then you're doing these other mechanical movements, if you will. And the thought process is like this. If you watch an NBA basketball player at the very highest level, you don't see them watching the ball as they dribble it, as they go down the court. They're doing a variety of tasks at the same time. And to put that, you know, in better perspective, if the brain was a computer, estimates are that the brain could probably process somewhere between like 7 billion to 7 trillion bits of data per second. But if someone remembers 20 numbers, we go, they're really smart. They're nowhere close, right, to what the brain is capable of doing. And when you think now, how are people exercising to really evolve their brain and get all these things? No one really does that because they're not even, one, gyms aren't set up that way, but two, they're not aware of all this potential. So it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like you just bought 1,000 acres, but you're just going to look at, you know, 2 square feet and ignore the rest of everything on your property. Yeah. And so what we try to do is get people exposed to things. Now, on top of what I just said, imagine now we have magnetic energy fields that people exercise in, or they do different movements in the field. We have different light fields, different electrical stimulation. And the end, the result is that now we're introducing some form of energy into the body most of the time, and we combine that with some form of movement. So even in like, we have some light beds, they basically look like suntan bed, but it's not ultraviolet light. It's either red, near infrared, or infrared type light. So it's red instead of blue light.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not much space, and I figure out people can exercise within the chamber, or we can electrically stimulate muscles in their body while they're in the chamber. So in other words, we're always trying to get, you know, more and more accomplished in less and less time.
Absolutely. And with with that electrical stim, is this microcurrent? Is it, what are you using?
So all of the above.
Okay.
We have gadgets. You know, so one, companies around the world always tell me how great their equipment is, and it's the best for whatever. Every device I've ever assessed has pros and cons. Is it maybe a better fit in our environment? So we've had all kinds of microcurrent devices. We have things like the Compax, the Power Dot. If I want to just like, if I want to have someone just kind of relax and have like a tool that kind of takes their muscles through a workout because they don't have good ability to move on their own, the Compax and the Power Dot are good tools for that. If I have someone that, let's say, has pain and I want to figure out a way to get them out of pain, then there's another technology called the ARP Wave, which is basically electrodes that we kind of find these pain points in the body that are compensation patterns, and we send electrical signals while they may either be lying, standing, sitting, or may have them working out or moving, different parameters. And then we have all kinds of other gadgets that come in all the time that use electricity to stimulate the body.
Wow. Yeah, now my brain is going on a whole nother tangent. Sorry, podcast folks. It's you guys will love it anyway. So I have a Juve. Have you heard of the Juve panel? Now I'm going, okay, should I be putting that in front of me in my home gym and adding that to my thing with the Compex on me? So now my head is going, of course, in 100 million directions. So what I wanted to ask about that is, do you do, I saw on your website that, you know, you will work with folks remotely. Do you write treatment protocols and do you write workout protocols with folks, including all of the possible gadgets that they can have on them?
Absolutely. Yeah. And so the short answer was the Juve, what the other stuff? And the answer is yes. And then in terms of do we write programs, the answer is yes. In terms of like if you said, hey, you know, how would I optimize things for everyone? There's a lot of therapeutic benefits to red light and near infrared light. But there's always like, at a certain level, there's always an ultimate barrier, right? So let's just say first, you got to get light. Mm-hmm. So you have this light around you. Now you run into issues that, well, what can actually interfere with the photons reaching the target? Now you get into some deep areas of physics that may or may not be, you know, acceptable for most people to understand. But we now know that the areas of homeopathy and the areas of quantum physics and biophysics and nanomedicine and things like that, they're slowly, oh, I should say material science, they're slowly coming together. And so what that means is, we will have scientific proof for how homeopathy works, but it's going to then create a whole new world because the latest methods that come out of the material science world of physics, most of the companies that are in the homeopathic space, they're not integrating, they're not using those methods yet. They're still going by a history of production or manufacturing a certain way. But we know we can now fingerprint a single water molecule in a gallon jug of water. So we have these capabilities now, and now it's opening up doors where, so imagine if we took the water in your body and we replaced the heavier hydrogen with a lighter hydrogen at a molecular level. Now we're changing viscosity. What that means is now everything at a molecular level moves better within your body, meaning water inside the cell, water outside the cell. So that area is referred to as light water therapy, if you will. Hmm. That type of water by itself has the ability to treat disease. And it gets into now, do you remember as a kid, like having a history class, you learn about Ponce de Leon and the Fountain of Youth?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
so there's actually places in Romania, Hungary, probably other countries, but they have it, but they just haven't discovered it yet. Where they found the water, it's still H2O, but the hydrogen atoms are different in these isolated places. So nature has created water that is actually very therapeutic on its own. Now just hold on to that thought. And now companies around the world contact me to basically take these different details and create stuff that has never been created before or in history. So one of the things I'm working on right now is taking water and replacing it with the hydrogen that's lighter and now making new structures of that water called hydrosomes. And think of the hydrosome, you're like a liposome, like a fat sphere. Mm-hmm. So imagine a water sphere. But the water sphere is so tiny, it can go through water channels in your cells. So now it's basically like passive diffusion coming in and out. And inside that water sphere, we could have active material. And this is where now it gets pretty advanced, way beyond what most people have ever been exposed to.
Yeah.
We now are looking at, we can deliver, we can increase the efficiency of delivery by 1 million times of pretty much anything.
That's better than liposomal.
Yeah, way better. And imagine there's a substance that you'd want to get, let's say for your own health, let's say you had a disease and you want to get this, but it's cost prohibitive. Let's say it's $1 million a day. We can now bring things down so that it would be $1 a day. So the most expensive stuff in the world anyone would be able to afford. And this is where now, you know, all these technologies become incredibly disruptive. And what's been happening is drug companies just buy them and shelve them. So lots of great people have developed very innovative ways to take, basically, they're just doing what nature already figured out. And then what happens is it'll work for people so well, it reduces the need for future treatments. So it has a negative cash flow for some companies by billions of dollars. So the solution is to buy the technology and shelve it. And people won't be using it anytime soon. So there's really disruptive stuff that's coming out on the horizon, because eventually other people will figure it out. And then you get to a point, let's say if 100 companies come out with a similar technology, they're not all going to be bought out, right, by drug companies or other companies that may lose money. So some of them will actually make it to the marketplace.
Well, I sure hope they do. We have a need for a different – we need different protocols out there. And, you know, one of the things I struggle with as a naturopath and an acupuncturist myself is, you know, I don't want to give people 500 pills to have to take in the herbal or supplement department, because it's no different, you know, than giving a whole bunch of pharmaceuticals. And sure, I would love to have targeted medicine and targeted, you know, water even better. Yeah. Everything requires water in our body. So absolutely. Yeah.
So, you know, with your acupuncture background, you know, you could take the same acupuncture points that you currently would use a needle with, and you could actually just put a laser at those points. And the laser doesn't even have to penetrate the skin. It could just be, they have like suction cups that just sort of like stick to the skin, but nothing, this light goes through. And you can get dramatically higher levels of adenosine production. And then you could literally take, you know, an unskilled person like myself, like I'm not a skilled acupuncturist. I only know points because doctors tell me them. But if they didn't say anything, I wouldn't know, you know, anything about it. And I had a buddy of mine's cardiologist, and he came in and he couldn't do a single chin up because his elbow, the muscles around his elbow were so inflamed.
So we took the
laser acupuncture gadget, and we just, you know, put like the suction cups at different points around. And 10 minutes later, he bangs out 15 chin ups, and he's like, dude. It's way how when people do things, they automatically become a muscle head.
So, absolutely.
Yeah, and you know, these guys got like 20 years of college. Now he's like, dude. But so anyway, yeah, he called me one day. We did one treatment on him, and he's never had pain ever since.
That's impressive. No, you definitely don't get that with just straight acupuncture.
No, well, I think part of it is that the other thing, like what I don't know what your experience has been like, but I've been finding more and more people have aversion to needles. And so I think, if you have, let's just say you did the best job possible, you're so skilled, people can't feel the needle going into their, you know, through their skin. If they have an aversion, there may be at a subconscious level, like a fear of from that needle in your body. So maybe their own thinking is interfering with their healing.
Oh, that or their fight or flight response.
Yeah, yeah. So imagine now, though, if it's like this cool Star Trek-looking light, nothing penetrates you, just visually, it's kind of like more of a wow, cool thing. So then that kind of gives you the opposite, like it's more likely to have a positive result because they didn't get stuck, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I had seen that on your website, but honestly, prior to that, I have not looked at any companies or anything of that nature. But I do know that it would definitely bring the barriers down for a lot of people to try acupuncture.
Now, do you guys do any dry needling or anything like that?
You know, I don't call it that only because if I'm going to needle someone, I'm going to be thinking about all the muscles that are involved in that channel and thinking about what's locked long, what's locked short, what's, you know, literally not turning on, what's in the whole pattern. And so I will repetitively stimulate a particular muscle in the same format as dry needling, but I won't just do one needle. So I guess what I would say is, I do things that are like dry needling, but I never leave a channel by itself. I do the whole thing.
Yeah. The reason why I was asking is we have, there's so many things now that can be stacked with the dry needling. In other words, like you could do two or three therapies simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
We know like which one of the three worked, but the patient feels better and it may reduce the total number of treatments. So generally speaking, then they're much happier, right? Imagine like if you say to someone, you have to come here six times, now all of a sudden you have to come here three times. It's easier for compliance, right, if it's less treatments needed.
Absolutely. What's your guys' if you don't mind saying, what is your average treatment turnaround for, let's not go with cancer because I know that that's a whole beast in and of itself, but say some of your athletes, I've seen you have a quite a wall of fame there. How long do athletes spend with you if they have a particular injury? What's on average for treatments?
So here's how it goes. If it's in season, I'm lucky if I see a guy a full day. So it's literally like this. They fly in, let's say, Tuesday morning, and they're out by Tuesday afternoon. So we have to produce a result in, let's say, 2 to 5 hours. And you don't get a second chance that season. It demands on their time. They're basically someone else is saying what they can do, you know, the head coaches and everything. What I tell most athletes is, right, the goal in season is to manage it. The goal, as soon as the season ends, is to fix it permanently. What happens, though, once guys have no pain, they assume they're fixed.
Mm-hmm.
And we know we can get people pain-free pretty quickly, but it doesn't mean there's a structural change. It just means you manage the pain signals in the body. So in terms of now, let's say we have a guy that comes out that'll spend 4 weeks. Most linebackers are gaining 20 to 30 pounds during that time because they're so depleted and run down. They have so much dysfunction or dysbiosis in their microbiome that literally improving the microbiome with dramatic reduction of inflammation in their body. And then they just hulk out. And it's kind of comical. Some of these guys, how much muscle they add so quickly. And then, of course, their teammates like, what drugs are you taking? Because they can't imagine someone just, you know, improving the microbiome. It does that. But they're not considering the possibility. If you can't break it down, you can't absorb it. If you can't absorb it, you're not getting any results from eating and taking supplements. It's kind of going through you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, same goes for cancer patients, too. I mean, in the same respect.
Yeah. So one of the things that, there's kind of been this evolution, like years ago, it used to be you would work out, and then you would do something after working out to kind of enhance recovery. And it doesn't matter if you talk about amino acids or red light therapy or magnetic field therapy or something. There's a technology called radio frequency, which is just, it's like electric. Think of it as electrical current going through the body, but it stimulates stem cells to migrate to the target area and repair it. And so then over time, guys start saying, well, it seems to work really well afterwards. What about if we did it before? And then some guys got way better results doing the therapy before. So let's say red light first, then you work out and red light again. Versus red light afterwards. And then some guys start saying, well, what if we just do what's called bookending, meaning we do the therapy before and after a workout. And so far, the results of bookending appear to be way better.
Wow. Wow.
That, you know, guys that we've had, we actually have a gentleman in his 70s right now that has been wanting to play golf for a long time and just hasn't been able to because of pain in his back afterwards. And 5 days, we were able to get him to the point where he played golf 2 days in a row with no issues afterwards.
Nice.
And part of that is from what we call bookending, meaning we're doing different therapies before and after other stuff that we're doing. So it's stimulating not just a reduction of inflammation, but stimulating healing.
Wow. Wow. Which, I mean, ultimately, inflammation leads to cancer. Inflammation, you know, leads to all kinds of issues. Like you're talking about the gut, all of those. So you guys have it dialed in on so many aspects. At one point, I saw a list on your website of 20 different things you offer in terms of therapies. And that's impressive.
Yeah, it's way more now. I get people ask me, do you have any information on it? And the challenge we have right now is companies are sending new technologies for us to evaluate. So if you ask me, like, right now, you know, give me a laundry list of what you have, and then in a week or two from now, it's going to be way longer. So we're trying to figure out, how do we create a system where stuff comes in, you know, where leveraging information that communicates it, but then it becomes overwhelming on the patient side. You know, imagine you're looking to come here as a patient, and I go, oh, we got 3,000 therapies. You're like, which one am I doing? Because you don't have enough time in the day to do them all, right?
Sure.
No one needs to do everything. I have access to stuff, and I don't do everything. Sure. The way I like to do it is, you know, there's a theory, and then there's like the practical aspect of things. And so let's just say you present with whatever symptoms you have, and the doctors here evaluate you and say, okay, I think you would benefit from, let's say, this light therapy. Well, you're going to try it, and they're going to say, I could feel a difference or I don't. And then if you say, you know what, Tom, I didn't really feel anything, I'm going to say, right, you know what, let's try this other therapy with magnetic field. And then you say, wow, I could really feel a difference. And here's how I'll kind of reconcile it, is that generally speaking, you do light to reduce pain, and you do magnetic field therapy to improve movement, range of motion, things like that. But now when you're talking about, you know, people walking through the door that have a wide range of possible issues going on, what you see a lot of times is one guy does like red light, and it's like, oh my God, my knee, my back feels great. The next guy does it, he's like, I didn't feel anything. Well, now the guy that doesn't feel anything from red light, we try magnetic field, he's like, oh my God, this made such a difference. So because we're not married to the technology, we're married to the outcome and the result, we have the freedom to try different things, and then we have the science behind it, but we still have your input. Like, subjectively, how did you feel? Did you feel it made a difference or not? Because you got to be able, we don't have the ability to precisely say, hey, you know, my vitamin B1 level is low right now. We don't have that sort of internal diagnostic set up for, you know, as humans. But we do know, hey, something's off. Just not, I don't have as much energy, or I'm not as strong or fast as I used to be. So something's going on. And so then this is where we have, you know, we have the technology and the science saying, hey, this should help that. But then we match it with your subjective assessment, like, yeah, I can feel it. And then what happens is eventually it'll plateau, and now we can go back to the other therapy. And then a lot of times we find something that didn't work day one, now it's day 10 and it's working for you.
Mm. It's like you have to turn something on or get something working better, and then the other one kicks in. It makes sense. It makes sense. Now, do you guys do, it looks like you do genetic testing, you do comprehensive labs on patients too when they come in.
Yep. So we can, so if it was like, let's say you have time and money, you know, we're not, you know, real world concerns. The way that the United States or any country in the world can actually leverage health as an asset as opposed to expense. Imagine the day you're born, every gene in your body has been tested, and that can be done from saliva. So it's not very invasive. You don't have to hurt the person to get anything out of them. And now you know every gene in your body, and now we know right away, hey, these foods are not good for you. Or this form of exercise is not ideal for you. Or hey, you have a predisposition for this condition, which your liver, your heart. Now you could be given, you know, your parents could be given, you know, here's stuff that you should start doing now with your child. So they embrace that behavior as they get older, as an adult. It would dramatically reduce the incidence of all kinds of diseases, because you'd have precise data early on. And just as a simple example, in the world of pharmacogenomics, which is basically like what genes you have and how does that affect your ability to metabolize and break down certain drugs, just introducing genetic testing in any area of medicine, but let's say like psychiatry, it can improve outcomes by anywhere from 20% to 80%, because instead of someone getting a drug that they have difficulty breaking down, something becomes toxic, or a drug that they break down too rapidly and now they don't really get the results from it, by tweaking the drug selection to their ability to metabolize it, you improve outcomes. And that can be done with nutrition. That can be done in all kinds of ways. The thing, though, here's where it's kind of like a conflict of interest. Doing this type of personalized medical approach, it's going to reduce the need for drugs overall. Because right away, you would be told, you know what, Janine, you can't break this drug down. And there's no other option for you here. So now let's look at a natural solution, which will probably be less expensive. And so now you're actually going to be directing people away from drugs. And so this is where there's a conflict of interest right now, because most doctors are not trained, like like most of your psychiatrists are not trained on natural options, right? In med school, they're getting the drugs and things like that. We have the ability that we can measure every single gene in the human body. We use a lab called NAgenomics, which has scientists and doctors from Harvard and Stanford, and these algorithms that are somehow connected to very prestigious computer science programs to figure out what to do to help people.
That's cool.
And then we go on, we do every vitamin and mineral. We use both Genova Diagnostics and Doctors Data and SpectraCell to do vitamin and mineral panels. Mm-hmm. There's newer labs, Vibrant America is one, there's a couple of others that also have the ability to measure vitamins and minerals. I don't have enough data on those labs yet to comment, you know, will we continue to use them going forward or not.
Yeah, I don't know those ones. I only know Genova and Doctor's Data. I use those in my office as well.
Yeah, the one thing that maybe because of your medical background, you know, what I see happening right now is lots of people are being, so consumers are being targeted by a lot of genetic testing. But the genetic testing is very misleading. So imagine, like, if you had 4 flat tires and you call up, you know, an automobile repair shop or tire repair shop, say, hey, I have flat tires, can you fix them? And they come and go, hey, we're going to fix just one. You would think, like, this place, these guys are, you know, they're idiots. How could they ignore the other 3? Well, we have 22,000 genes approximately. But what's being made commercially available to most people is like, well, we're going to test 12. We test 20. And so now you're given, like, kind of like that one tire fix approach, like you're getting bits of information. And so you're thinking, oh, this is a problem, or, oh, I'm fine. When meanwhile, you may have all these other genes that are exactly the opposite. So the FDA has already ruled, you got to be very careful in what you conclude from these small arrays of genes, because it's misleading. Like, let's say you have one gene for breast cancer, you may have 10 other genes that fight cancer. So the likelihood of you getting breast cancer would be very minimal. And what I've been seeing as we got now, we have complete genomic profiles on generations of families. So it's kind of like, you know, a grandparent and then their kids and so forth. Many people have diseases that they don't have the genes for. So that argues, it supports some of the data done on genetically identical twins by Claude Bouchard many years ago, where Dr. Bouchard said, hey, most of what we're seeing is in these genetically identical twins is from the environment. It's not genetic. So it's kind of like they test these two guys that live on different parts of the country. One is skinny and one's obese. Well, their genes are exactly the same in terms of, you know, they're genetically identical. So why is one obese and one skinny? And he's still looking at all these other things. And what he had concluded is that maybe genetics ultimately, maybe they're like, let's say 18 to 22%. So let's just say 20%, give or take a few points. The rest, let's say the 80% was roughly the environment. And most people would say, oh, like the reason I have a problem, it's genetic. And it might be true, but they're ignoring that you got 80% that you can control.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of affecting on a minor thing you can't control, that could be reframed to look at all the opportunity you have to make positive change. And so you kind of have like older data, newer data, kind of all really saying the same thing. So like, for example, the increase in obesity in the United States, basically people aren't moving as much as they used to. That's a huge impact because movement affects gene expression in our muscles. That gene expression affects how you handle glucose. There's all this other data, like, you know, now there's a lot of people concerned about weed and dairy.
Right.
In the 70s, every runner ate tons of pasta. 8 tons in.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, so there may be some concern, like, was the wheat back then genetically modified like today? You know, there's definitely some real world concerns. There's definitely changes in the micronutrients and in the soil. There's changes in the top layer of soil. There's changes in the microbiome. But even when we take people that are morbidly obese in controlled conditions, they lose weight with no problem. So it tells us that, you know, there's that we all have the ability to do something to make a positive impact on our health. And what needs to be done is maybe the messaging should be that here's what you need to look at to help yourself. Because what I see right now is people wasting tons of money on fad diets and supplements, and they ignore that you get better results hiring a personal trainer than taking a weight loss supplement. Yet most people would complain about, you know, paying a trainer $50 to $150 an hour, but they'll drop more than that on supplements that ultimately won't work.
Oh my gosh. Amen. Amen on that. I can't stress that enough. And Dr. Tom, I've got a boogie to go see patients to spread the word about what you're saying right now, but that is absolutely the word that needs to go out there, is we are products of our environments. We can control what we do. We can control the exercise we do. We can move our butts. We can control how we eat. And yes, spending time with having someone who's going to be your accountability buddy, whether it's a personal trainer or whether it is a physical therapist, it's true. It really does make a difference. And holy cow, your office is doing everything that is like a dream clinic for me. It's awesome. I think it's just impressive. And I'm going to be telling people about you because you're not that far from us.
You know, you can always grab your husband and just come on down to Arizona.
Oh, I'm telling you, Arizona, you know, compared to the rain here, sometimes I do think about it. So on that note, let's tell everybody your offices are in Arizona. Where exactly in Arizona are you located, and what's the best way for folks to get a hold of you?
So we're located in Scottsdale, Arizona. It's pretty close to Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport. A ton of people fly in and fly out. One, when they see the experience here, they just love it. Two, as far as how to get in touch with us, easiest thing, just go to causenta.com, causenta.com. And there's a form. You can fill out a form online. You get a free consult, meaning we'll talk with you and share with you, here's how we would approach your situation. And if you think like it'll be helpful, then you go forward. But if you don't think it'll help you, then you don't have to, you know, there's no one hounding you. There's no salesperson calling you to take action. You got a lot of freedom. And then we'll give you some free stuff to help you get educated about what you're dealing with and you know, what possible scenarios are available to help you.
Wow. Dr. Tom, I sincerely appreciate you taking all this time to chat with my audience, and gosh, all the information, and your website's a wealth of information. So folks, go over to his website at causenta.com because it's really, really, really informative and the videos are great. Thank you again.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity to share the message on your show.
Hey everybody, Dr. Janine Krause here. If you liked what you heard today, then head over to drjkrausend.com to find my free resources and information to know when I post something new that's juicy that you might want to check out. Plus, head over to where you get your podcasts and like, subscribe, and write a review to help get the word out about me and help others at the same time to find me. It really does help, and I really appreciate all of your reviews.